I have been scrolling through players on transfermarket.us that have been listed out of contract as of June 30th, 2022. So these are players that don't have clubs or will not have clubs going into the next summer. So if you throw some money at them in January, you know, you see where it falls. Definitely not going to put Kylian Mbappe on my wish list. That's just too soon. We don't have the infrastructure at the club.
Plus, he already was asked. There's a story. So, I guess Antoine Griezmann was playing Football Manager, and he picked Newcastle. And I guess he eventually signed Kylian Mbappe, and Mbappe found out in real life and laughed and said, "I'll never move to Newcastle because it rains too much." So there's also that.
Okay.
He's not wrong.
Right.
I will say what intrigues me, but he's injured right now. But I wonder if it could be doable just for the sake of the future. Pedri. Because he's out of contract in the summer of 2022, and Barcelona is pretty cash-strapped because they recorded a 408 million euro loss for last year.
I would say yes, only I think you're going to get another Barcelona product or a current Barcelona player that I think would prevent that and would allow Barcelona to keep Pedri.
Who do you think?
Coutinho.
This sounds like excellent podcasting content.
I am recording though, so yeah.
Oh my bad. Okay.
I do not want to leave Coutinho at all.
Well, that's a shame because you're going to get him.
No, don't wish that into existence, Adam.
That's exactly where they're going to go. All right, let's continue this once we started the podcast. All right. Hello, one and all. And welcome to another international week. Actually, it's the tail end of an international week here on We Ate All the Pies. Thank God it's almost over. My name is Adam. We have back with us this week from Macon, Georgia, Caleb. Hello, Caleb.
This week I discovered that the kazoo was invented or designed, created in Macon, Georgia. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, lots of historic town musically for lots of reasons, including that one.
That's a pretty big claim to fame. I feel like a kazoo was a huge deal when you were a kid, and I feel like it sort of fell out of favor as we got to be adults. I wonder why.
I mean, it's not the Allman Brothers or Little Richard, but you know, it's still up there.
And also joining us this week is Mr. Moneybags himself, Jordan, who currently is on the road between Greenville, Texas, in Sherman, Texas. Hello, Jordan. I apologize if you can't hear me over the jingling of coins.
Here comes the money. Here we go. Here comes the money. Actually, I'm not driving, sir. I'm taking my Saudi Arabian helicopter from Greenville to Sherman. You know, when God just blesses you so much, it makes the world a better place. It really does. Since the takeover occurred, since it finally became official, since the skies opened up, shine down on the city of Newcastle.
I'm going to stop you right there because there's no way sun's shining in Newcastle. It's impossible.
Well, it did that day, sir.
Okay.
And also, it showered beer because, as you can imagine, with the removal of the sports direct signs from pitch side and the eviction of Mike Ashley from the owner's office, the Newcastle faithful, majority brethren, rained down cans of the old brown ale all throughout, you know, the streets of Newcastle. It was a glorious, glorious sight just to see that much happiness explode all at once.
Well, be careful on that Saudi helicopter. I hear that the missions they go on aren't always that great. So
if I have to hide a body or two at this point, I don't care.
Oh my God.
I have a future. There is hope for my football club. What once was a internal pessimism that resided within me has been cast away. I am now an optimist.
I liked him better before. So we will be talking about the Toon Takeover a lot here on this pod. It actually is kind of what has dominated the conversation since everybody's away on international breaks. But there were some results to talk about: England results, United States results, and more in the ways of World Cup qualifying. Top Shelf picks are back this week, of course, because we have games coming up this weekend, which we will talk about in a minute. And there's some Premier League news regarding yet another player who seems to have found himself on the wrong side of the law. So we'll cover that here in a minute, but I want to start with this Newcastle takeover. And I kind of want to see, you know, I'll kind of contribute here and just kind of talk about what this means for the Premier League, what it means for the sport, things like that. But I want to start with you, Jordan. I want to ask you to take off your optimism cap for a minute and put on your analytical cap and just sort of answer this straight up. Do you think Newcastle fans are happy? Are they happier to have this new ownership group, this public investment fund, Saudi Arabia, this consortium headed by Amanda Staveley? Are they happy about that, or are they happier that Mike Ashley is gone? Which one are they happier about more?
So,
I know that was grammatically incorrect. Which one are they happier about?
So at first, the first day or so, you could say that they were happier that Mike actually was gone. That the eternal treadmill of lower mid-table of the Premier League, you know, then relegation maybe once every 5 years is over. Just all the things that have occurred in Mike Ashley's tenure as owner of Newcastle, the way he treats, you know, Kevin Keegan, Alan Shearer, other club legends like Les Ferdinand, the Jonas Gutierrez incident, you know, more recently just, you know, having a world-class manager in Rafa Benitez who stayed with you when you got relegated and then brought you back up, and you didn't put any investment into his vision of the future for Newcastle, which I believed at the time was very sustainable, and it wasn't, you know, reaching that far. Let's see. I could list other things that Mike actually did wrong. Buying House of Fraser for £90 million. Buying, I think, Debenhams, which is another clothing retailer, for some unknown amount of money, but not putting anything back into really the only asset that he had in his empire that could have appreciated in value. Now, with what has come out from Amanda Staveley and the chairman about what's going to happen with the future of the club, specifically like the investment in the infrastructure and in the training academy, we are now, as members of, you know, majority faithful, are excited about the future. Less so about what, you know, just the release of Mike Ashley being gone a couple days ago.
There's a really interesting chart out there in the interwebs that I'm pretty sure is accurate, and I'll kind of explain why. But basically, it talks about Premier League clubs and how much they've spent in investment, I want to say, over the past 10 years. And the reason I think it's pretty accurate is because Spurs are at the very top, and they just built a stadium, so of course they're going to be at the very top because they spent a lot of money to build that new stadium. But what was interesting to me is at the very, very bottom was Newcastle in terms of, I mean, they'd barely spent any money in terms of their infrastructure. Not to say that St. James's Park necessarily needs a lot in terms of investment. It's a very good stadium. It's 52,000 fans or more. You could obviously expand on that, but it is one of the biggest in the Premier League, or at least it has been. So But you know, like you mentioned, the youth academy, the training facilities, things like that, that needed that investment or could have used that investment weren't getting them. And I think that's a big reason why Mike Ashley has just sort of been seen as this terrible owner, because he never put anything back into the club. I want to look at this because obviously there's a lot of talk about the money that's behind this. And Caleb, you and I are neutrals in this, relatively speaking. And so I feel like we could, you know, kind of talk about that a little bit with a somewhat of an unbiased look. It's the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia that is funding this. I think 80% of the investment came from PIF, and obviously they'll have at least one representative on the Newcastle board, even if they're not necessarily the head of the board, but you know, they're going to hold a lot of weight. And Saudi Arabia has been in the news, let's just say, lately for some not very good reasons. We can list them all, but I think everybody kind of knows what I'm talking about. And there's a lot of talk of, you know, sports washing and, you know, essentially using the football club to paint over the cracks of human rights abuses and other crimes that have been allegedly committed by this Saudi regime. However, you know, it's not like the crown prince is on the board of Newcastle calling the shots, although it is still their money. So, I mean, how, I don't know, from a neutral perspective, Caleb, how controversial really is this? Is it a lot of people, do you think, just sort of saying things just to say them and to point this out, and maybe it's a bit of sour grapes that it didn't happen to their club? Or is it legitimate? Because this has been going on for a while now, and we can list lots of clubs that have been, that are owned by some owners that maybe aren't exactly above board, let's just say.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, I think it's worth discussing. I think it's worth having a conversation about. I mean, it's one of those things where you look at all of the money that touches sports across the world, and obviously it's not all tied to, it's not all coming from Mother Teresa, so you acknowledge that. You understand that there's, you know, connections to, you know, a lot of this wealth that has been generated and that is being used to purchase and run, you know, not just soccer clubs, but, you know, clubs of all kinds, you know, comes from a wide variety of sources. And obviously this is a takeover that has concerned folks for a number of months. It's one of the reasons why it took so long to be completed. It's one of the reasons why, you know, there have been promises to the Premier League, binding assurances that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia would not control Newcastle. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the money is coming from, is connected to a country and a country's leadership structure that has justifiably taken a lot of criticism for human rights violations, et cetera. Does that mean that, you know, Jordan shouldn't root for Newcastle anymore, or this is bad for the fans and people of Newcastle? I don't think so. But, you know, as an independent observer, you know, would you like to not have Saudi Arabia pouring money into an English football club? Sure. But, you know, unfortunately, it's just not the world we live in. And, you know, there's a lot of unfortunately, you know, when you're talking about this amount of money, you know, there's only so many places where it can come from. And I would also say that for folks who want to be critical of it, I think that's completely fine. But I would also encourage them to look at things like, if you really want to care about Saudi Arabia and the way they use their wealth and human rights violations in that country, then maybe there's other places to start. Like, and we won't get into those, but, you know, you could, I don't know, Google U.S. Saudi Arabian arms sales, you know, and military, you know, and aircraft sales, and we could maybe start there, not maybe with Newcastle.
Say, we're not going to get, I'll get into it. Look at your own government.
And if you're
British, look at your own government.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to make light of it in the sense that I think there are legitimate concerns, but I also don't think that, like, this is, like, if you want to fight, you know, metaphorically, if you want to die on a hill discussing this, I don't think the Newcastle takeover is where you should start. I guess that's my point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I told this to you earlier this week on the phone, Jordan, but you know, I subscribe to The Guardian. There are numerous reasons why I do that. Number one, I think they do good journalism. And number two, I think they do really good writing. But they never had the best sports section. I'll just throw that out there. They're not the best. I think, based on my own research, the best sports section from a newspaper or in the UK is from UK newspaper perspective is one that I absolutely cannot give money to because they're just way too, we'll just say they're way too far the other direction. But it's been so annoying this week, the opinions coming out of The Guardian, because it's sort of been like that. I don't know. There was this one column, and I can't even remember what it was called, but it basically was saying this is a really good time for us to kind of go back and you know, look again at, you know, the way our clubs are being bought and the way that, you know, the way that we react to having certain ownerships. And it's like, look, where's this been for the past 10 years? I mean, if you truly are that concerned, here's a great example. Qatar. They are hosting the World Cup next year. This time next year, we'll be gearing up for the World Cup in Qatar. Do I like the fact that it's going to be in Qatar? No. Do I like the fact that it's going to be the winter? Absolutely not. Do I like the fact that Qatar has, you know, on numerous occasions, it seems, built these stadiums with some labor practices that certainly in the West we would frown upon? For various reasons. No, I don't like that at all. I think it's bad and it's not good. And you know, FIFA deserves these headlines for picking such a terrible host country. I'm sorry. It was just a terrible idea to begin with. Am I going to watch it? You bet I am. It's the World Cup. Of course I'm going to watch it. So I'm upset about it, but I'm not upset to the point that, you know, I'm just going to completely leave over it. And I just feel like the amount of, particularly from The Guardian, from that section of football fans, the amount of hand-wringing and pearl-clutching is just, it's ridiculous. Look, if you're that concerned about it, there's a lot of stuff you could have been doing by now, other than right now. So I don't know. I don't know how much of that is just for show or what. I think it's all going to calm down eventually, but yeah, I mean, I like kind of the way the you put it, Caleb, is it's just sort of, look, you know, yeah, this is not great, but I don't know, is it the hill to die on? I don't think so, personally. Jordan, I have another question for you. That this is a bit more fun. So obviously there's
Hey, Adam.
Yeah, yes.
Real quick, I have actually something to say about that too. Hey, you know, you're talking about the Guardian articles, you know, the pearl clutching and the hand wringing of, you know, is this ownership group a step too far? You know, what kind of happened to, you know, our... And my question is, to people writing these articles, is your worldview that narrow? Countries other than like those of the European Union and well, you know, actually engage in some sort of sports washing already. I mean, if you look at the NFL sport washes the U.S. We have flyovers almost every weekend. We have the national anthem sung before every game in professional sports in the United States. Is that itself not considered sports washing? So, you know, my suggestion is look at the larger world around you and...
It's all terrible, apparently, according to your argument.
And like Caleb said, this is not the hill to die on. If you are concerned about what the country of Saudi Arabia, specifically the public investment fund, is doing with its money, or, you know, what your country should do with its money in relation to Saudi Arabia, talk about the arms deals. Talk about, airplanes for oil, basically. This is, a very small tentacle on a larger octopus in the globe in the globe.
It's a unique analogy there. I'm going to move on, and I'm just going to ask. So you've got this money now, Jordan, and I asked you this earlier in the week to do some homework, and I'm expecting a nice little list here, or at least one good name. So, realistically, in January, who will be the new Newcastle regime's first signing?
All right, Adam. I am taking my Christmas list to Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
Let me give you the names, not in any particular order.
You have to go all the way. You just have to go to Tyneside. You don't have to go to Saudi Arabia, but anyways.
I'll have to. I'll take my list, and hopefully they'll listen to it and check off a couple. Okay. The most realistic first signing I see in Newcastle's immediate future is James Tarkowski from Burnley.
Really? I'm sorry. You've got this money. You've got billions behind you. You can go out and get. I mean, not realistically, but you can go out. Think of the players who are available now. And I saw that story, and I was just like, really? James Tarkowski, okay. That's going to be your first one. Mr. used to okay. be on England, isn't anymore, James Tarkowski. Mr. on, you know, relegation form Burnley, James Tarkowski. I don't know. I'm sorry. Okay. That one just seems so weird to me.
Adam, listen to me. I'm just saying most realistic.
Would I know.
It be the most
but that's...
exciting? No. But it would be an improvement over Fabian Schär or Kieran Clark right now. He is a top-level Premier League defender who happens to be on a more defensive-minded team than Newcastle. And he's unhappy. So, you know, I'd be okay seeing that because that would be a bolster to the center backs. That'd be fine by me.
No, I get it. It's a good signing. It's like anticlimactic.
Going down in likelihood, let me continue on my list because I got a bunch.
Okay.
Matthias Ginter from Borussia Mönchengladbach, 27-year-old center back, has played in the back three in that system at Gladbach. Out of contract as of June 30, 2022. I'd be interested in him. Less likely, we're going up. Nicholas Sewell, out of contract in 2022 with Bayern.
That's pretty good.
Which, from what I have seen, he might be the odd man out in that center back future with Chris Richards being denied a $20 million move to Hoffenheim last summer.
Hold on. It's Richards, isn't it?
Sorry, Richards.
Okay. He's not French.
I misspoke for a second. Chris Richards. The rumor was that, you know, the Hoffenheim loan he's currently on was going to be a permanent move for £20 million. That got denied by the Bayern Munich board. It seems like he, I believe another young player, are going to slot in as their center back starting next season. So Sewell is on the outside looking in. I would like him as a center back. We're going to go into the midfield now. Quarantine Tolisso from Bayern Munich.
Okay, this is now we're spicing things up. This is getting better. Okay.
Out of contract. For immediacy sake, we need a right. We obviously need some depth at the fullbacks. Unfortunately, there's not that many out of contract. I'd be okay with Serge Aurier for a year or two. Just something to immediately stabilize us. Let's see.
I've never heard Serge Aurier and stabilized used in the same sentence.
I understand that, Adam, but when you have, you know, Javier Manquillo and then Jacob Murphy as your starting two, as your main two right backs, you know, you could use anything back there, okay?
Right.
All right. So let's see, who else out of contract? You know, just going down
can
list.
I just say, why are we going to for players out of contract? Why wouldn't you just, you know, like I said, you've got money now. You don't have to wait for these guys to be. Let me explain something to you, Jordan. You can pay transfer fees.
You're gonna have to explain that. You might have to explain that to them as if he's been a Newcastle fan for a long time.
See, Jordan, the way this works.
About how it works when you have money.
You pay money up front, and that buys them out of their contract, and so you can get them in January. So you don't have to worry about players who are just out of contract. Just to explain that. That's how the transfer market works.
I understand, Adam.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Just making sure you don't have too much Mike Ashley PTSD going on right now.
I'm sorry. I'm still under that Mike Ashley mindset, okay? I was looking at the bargain bin, so to speak. But, hey, you know what? Here's an interesting name. Speaking of the bargain bin, Eddie Nketiah from Arsenal. I would love to see him in Newcastle. You know what? You know, here's another name. And it's not going to happen because he's 34 and he loves Napoli. Dres Mertens is out of contract. Let's give him a shot. World class striker or winger, bring him in. Andrea Belotti, European Cup winning Italian forward, out of contract. Hell, you want a big name? I got a big name for you, Adam. Pedri, the 18-year-old, 90 million pound rated forward for Barcelona, who are cash strapped, is out of contract.
That's a good name. However, I'm gonna replace that with a bigger name, who I do think you actually will go after, who is Barcelona's Coutinho. I think he is coming to Tyneside.
If Philippe Coutinho comes to Tyneside because you brought this in to the world, Adam, I'm gonna punch you the next time I see you.
What's wrong with him?
Oh my God! First off, so you're playing wonderful at Liverpool.
Yes,
mind you. You're the midfield magician.
Yes,
you have like Mo Salah level like charisma. Like you're loved by the cop, and then you work your way out. You work your way out of Liverpool in the worst way possible
for an insane transfer fee.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, didn't he not tell Klopp that he's not going to stay if Barcelona puts in a transfer fee?
Right. I mean, at least he was straightforward about it.
Yeah. I don't know. No. No. I would not want him in the black and white.
He's coming. That's one of the many rumors. It's one of the more believable ones.
You know who I would like to see? And this is the guy I've been currently calling the future Man City striker. Bring me Ivan Toney.
Yeah, let's let him. You let him go. Let's go get him back for what, 50 mil? Let's just drop that.
Hey, you know what? That was under the old regime. This is the new baby. He'd be better than Joe Ellington at this point.
I
actually have the definitive word. I'm interested in your takes on those, yeah. Adam, but I actually have the definitive word on how the transfer market's going to play out for Newcastle, in case you're interested.
Yeah, go for it.
So this is according to the Evening Chronicle, which, you know, take with a grain of salt. Apparently Newcastle could spend almost £200 million and still be fair play regulations because Mike Ashley's such a tightwad. The soccer simulation game Football Manager 2021.
Ah.
Editing a new game save file and updating all transfers as of October 8th, placing Mike Ashley as a club's owner with a new ownership structure nicknamed Sugar Daddy, and improving the club's reputation. Newcastle's first and most expensive signing is Christian Pulisic.
Oh, wow.
From Chelsea for a club record $54 million. Followed by £54 million, followed by £39.5 million Napoli defender Kalidou Koulibaly.
Koulibaly.
Also on the list, Fulham's own Anthony Robinson and US men's national team Anthony Robinson, which is a good segue into the next segment. Brighton's Lewis Dunk and Serge Aurier mentioned, earlier. So anyway, that's according to Football Manager 2021, which you know is infallible. So
it's the bastion of accuracy. Actually, those aren't terrible signings. Why did you come with Kalidou Koulibaly, Jordan? That's a perfect signing.
You can't have Anthony Robinson, though. He's staying.
Okay, first off, Kalidou Koulibaly
right.
would be a great signing.
Yeah.
But do you think the player that has had more infamy in Italy for the past two seasons because of racist incidents that were perpetrated against him would want to come to England at this moment?
I mean, I would say that England is far less racist than Italy. I'm just gonna sit on that hill right now. Because I believe
it. There's a lot of geopolitical conversations going on in this podcast.
I know. I don't even know how you can make that comparison. Hey, here's Paolo Di Canio, right, was in England. He goes to Lazio for like a hot minute, and he's making a Nazi salute. I can't make this stuff up.
And Adam.
Yes.
You know, if I had my druthers, which I do because I have more money than God at this point for my football club, if I was to choose a Chelsea young player, it definitely wouldn't be Christian Pulisic. It would be Kai Havertz.
That's a good one. That's a good one too. I would argue that Pulisic is more realistic than Havertz because he's having, let's just say, not as good of a time at Chelsea, and would probably be more than likely to say, "Yeah, I could do with a change of pace."
But can we settle how to say his last name? By the way, I've heard it five different ways.
Pulisic, I think is how you say it. Is that right, Jordan?
Pulisic.
Boy, you were asking the wrong person. Because
I've heard Pulisic. I've heard Pulisic. Pulisic. Yeah, I've heard Pulisic. Like, and he's American. He plays for the United States National. We should be able to say this kid's last name, but I've heard it like eight different ways. Christian, if you listen to this podcast, would you reach out to me? Explain how to say your last name since you're not playing soccer for Chelsea or the U.S. right now.
Hey,
maybe you could reach out and let me know how to play it.
Christian, just give us a ring and let us know.
Drop me a line. Yeah. Thanks, bud.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe Pulisic is having issues at Chelsea because he's kind of having Jack Wilshere's he's experiencing Jack Wilshere syndrome, which is you pick up a
he's tag, smoking?
You pick up a little niggling injury and you're out for 6 months.
Oh, right. I don't think these are little niggling injuries. I think those are pretty, like, he does have injury problems. He's getting to that point. Yeah. It is concerning.
It's his hamstring. So, yeah. No, why would I want him? Why would I want a player that can play maybe one out of every seven matches? It'd be Kai Havertz, and then, you know what? I'm going to speak into existence because, Adam, you know, we talked about this in the text thread between me and you.
Right.
I want the 18-year-old. I want the striker for the U.S. men's national team who has that touch in front of goal and who is dearly, sorely missed against Panama. Bring me El Train. I want to be on the Ricardo Pepi train in black and white, baby.
He has to stay. He has to stay for the good of my own sanity. We will. Let's talk about Pepi here in a little bit. There's one more thing I want to talk about with the new cut. I said we're going to talk about this a lot, and sure enough, we are. But there's one more thing I want to bring up, and I just want to throw this out there. So, obviously, the ownership's in. As far as we can tell, Steve Bruce is still in the job. However, that could change very quickly if you believe the papers. The season's going to continue. They're not going to be able to bring in new players, at least until January. Even then, obviously, they're not going to be able to overhaul the entire squad in one go, especially not in just 1 month. So, this is going to take some time to get going. Meanwhile, there is still a Premier League campaign to fight. We still have this Newcastle squad sitting here in front of us. Yes, it's exciting. They have a new owner. It's probably they're going to have a new manager here pretty soon. But even then, can this current squad, even with maybe a few additions, are they good enough to stave off relegation? Let's try and answer that question seriously here. Is this squad good enough to stave off relegation to prevent that? Is it that they're just being played so badly right now by Steve Bruce and a quick change will result in just this great mid-table team that suddenly has appeared. Or are the players good enough? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. They're still without a win this season. So, I mean, are we thinking, are they good enough right now to stave off relegation, or do they need some serious investment?
Adam?
Yeah.
First of all, you have definitely not watched enough Newcastle football this season.
I think I have.
Okay, to stay out of the bottom three and
right.
to survive in the next season, they're clearly good enough with a couple additions in key places. They need at least three new signings in January. I would prefer five. But if you get a new manager, in basically immediately, this club will survive. Will survive for next season in the Premier League.
Okay.
I will put this on the podcast right now. If either one of you wants to take a bet on me on that Newcastle will survive and not be relegated this year, I will take it. With the condition that it's a jersey or kit of your choice. Do I got any takers?
No, because I don't think they're going to be relegated. But I was just curious about kind of what our thoughts are, considering that this is still a team that has not had a win yet this season, and is continuing to struggle. I do think that they can stay up because Steve Bruce has kept them up before, and I don't think Steve Bruce is that good of a manager. I'm not going to take you up on your bet because I agree with you, but I do think it's interesting that everybody's talking about all these new signings when there's still a campaign to play. Like, you still got to get there, and everybody's just assuming that Newcastle's going to be in the Premier League, and so far, this squad has not shown that it can do that. In my opinion, I do think that they're capable of it, but I just think it's interesting that everybody's sort of looking over the fact that they've still got, what, 30 games to play? Something like that? I think it's 30. So anyways, Caleb, any thoughts on that? Newcastle, can they stay up?
I would just say that it's so hard to tell right now, just because you have to figure there's going to be a lot of positivity coming from the fans and from probably players on the club from this takeover. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty. You could see a manager get sacked. You could see a bunch of players come in January. So, I mean, I think they're going to be near the bottom of the table until then, and it'll take a little while to get some of those players acclimated. But the truth of the matter is the bottom of the Premier League is a bunch of not very good teams, and it's not going to take a lot to stay up, I don't think.
Yeah.
So they'll probably still be in the bottom three come Boxing Day, but I think come in March, they'll be pretty safe. I mean, I don't think you're going to have to score a lot of points to stay up this year.
Solid prediction. Yeah, I agree. I do think, between Norwich and Southampton are having their troubles, Burnley are having troubles, Leeds I think are only just recently kind of getting going. So.
Hey, Adam.
Yes?
A couple of pods ago we discussed, whether or not we want to make any changes to our preseason predictions.
I do.
Can I make a change in my prediction, please, if I may be allowed by rules of
Very pod? Quickly. Very quickly, because we have to move on.
Okay. I had Newcastle getting relegated.
Right.
This season, along with Burnley and Norwich. I am officially moving them out of the relegation zone.
Okay.
They are staying up. I am dropping Leeds into the relegation zone.
Interesting.
Because they are not defensively stout enough to turn draws into wins. Now, they could score goals. And it seems like Rafinha can, appear on that, upper right part of the box and just like work his magic. But under Marco Bielsa's system, this season especially, they've shown that they are not defensively capable enough to turn draws into wins. So I'm moving Leeds the Lily Whites, because they play defensively like the Lily Whites, into the relegation zone?
I think they will stay up, and I'm gonna say right now, just because he's kind of on the minds given the Newcastle manager talk, I think he will stay up. I think Bielsa will stay on for the season. I think he'll leave at the end of the season, because they'll stay up, but they'll be in the bottom of the table. And I think Frank Lampard will be the next Leeds manager. That's my prediction there. So just some quick Premier League news here, and actually this is some sad news, disappointing news, I guess would be the word. Brighton midfielder Yves Bissouma, he was reportedly arrested on a complaint of sexual assault. I don't know if he has been formally charged yet, but he was hauled out of a nightclub over the past weekend. There's some video of that going around the internet, and he also joins a growing list of Premier League stars to have similar issues. Benjamin Mendy, the Manchester City left back, who was refused bail for a third time this past week, and he has been formally charged with four counts of rape, and I think his court case actually started this week, so that one's pretty set. And then, of course, there's the whatever's going on. I don't really know. We haven't really heard anything out of that. If either of you has an update on this, I would appreciate it, but I don't think there's any news about him. Gylfi Sigurdsson, who I believe is still on the books at Everton, but was under investigation for some alleged things that I don't really want to go into, because I don't really know what's going on exactly with that. So I don't want to say, you know, what is and what isn't. I don't think anybody's come out and confirmed that Gylfi Sigurdsson is the player involved. Everybody just assumes that he is because he's kind of incognito. So kind of an interesting thing here in this first half of the season, a lot of Premier League players getting into, you know, like I said, the wrong side of the law kind of thing, which is just, I find it very interesting. But Yves Bissouma, that one does hurt. I think he was a good young midfielder. And so if this is serious and if this goes forward, that could really, really be damaging, obviously for him, but for Brighton as well. So anybody else heard anything about that? Any news on those fronts?
You know, Adam, since I alerted you to the tweet thread early this summer about the unknown Everton player that was accused of solicitation of a minor.
Yeah.
Which it was rumored and still heavily rumored to be Gylfi Sigurdsson. He was reading from the Adam Johnson playbook, unfortunately. I've not heard any updates on that.
Okay. Yeah, so that was kind of the issue, and that's why I want to just kind of be careful about that, because it's not been officially named, but so anyways, that's Yves Bissouma. International break time. Let's have a look at what we've had some results now. We're well into it. Like I said, the light is at the end of the tunnel. And we will look at England and the United States. So we'll start with England. First of all, last Saturday, they very handily defeated Andorra. Chilwell, Saka, Tammy Abraham, James Ward-Prowse, Jack Grealish, all scoring in a 5-0 rout of the Micronation in Andorra. Interestingly enough, the day before that game went off, during a live update from Sky Sports News, the gantry, which is the English football term for the part of the stadium where the announcers sit, where like the stat keeper sits, and not necessarily the press box area, but sort of like a game operations center, if you will, it caught on fire and burned to the ground. It was a pretty intense fire, and there was some fears that if any damage was done by that fire to the synthetic turf, the plastic pitch that they played on, that they may not be able to play the game. The game did go ahead. England won 5-0, but that was just really, I don't know if you guys saw a video of that, but it was that was an inferno. Like, that was really intense.
I did, after you alerted me to it.
Yeah.
It was very intense, and it was surprising that England lit it up just as equally intense on the next day.
Terrible pun.
Yeah, I know. I had one in me.
That wasn't surprising, though. I would expect that they would just annihilate Andorra.
So, Adam, curious question here, because you know more about, you know, UEFA, you know, competition rules than the rest of us do. So why does Andorra play on a synthetic pitch? Is it because they are a mountainous, landlocked country between Spain and France? And so they don't have, I guess, you know, adequate room to grow grass for an actual grass pitch.
Well, I think they just decided that for them and for the association, it was cheaper for them to shell out for just getting a plastic pitch and not having to replace it so often. And up until recently, I don't think UEFA allowed that at the top level of competition. You had to have a grass pitch, but they have changed the rules, and so you are able to do that. In fact, I remember when in the Champions League you could not have a plastic pitch. It had to be, and of course now that's changed. I mean, we saw Young Boys in Switzerland. I think they play with one as well. So yeah, those rules changed recently.
And another question I have, so say that pitch is damaged to where you cannot play a match on. Would they do a change of venue to either Spain or France?
I have absolutely no idea. I have no idea because it didn't happen. I mean, the game went forward, so I don't know. I don't know what you would have done. They may have looked to change it. It also might depend on why the match can't go forward, because I highly doubt that UEFA basically would have told Andorra, hey, you can't. You have to forfeit this because of this fire, which was probably not entirely in their control. But I don't know. I don't know what they would have done. Fortunately, it did go forward. And so it was a good win for England in Andorra. They came back home to Wembley today, and they drew 1-1 with Hungary. John Stones getting the header to equalize for England in that match. They had a few chances. I saw the second half of this one. They had a few chances late on to get the winner, but it's still a good result. They are still top of Group I by 3 points. They have a tricky test, fortunately, at home, but in November they will face Albania, and Albania is currently battling with Poland for that very important second spot in the playoffs. So the top spot, you automatically go through to the World Cup. The second spot will go into a playoff round, which I guess they will play in March, I think. I guess they would have to, because usually it's played in November of the year before the World Cup, but I think because of the schedule stuff and all that stuff. So England-Albania coming up next, and then England finish by playing yet another micronation, San Marino. Hopefully there's no fire this time. And now, on to the United States. Now, I have not watched a whole lot of U.S. action. I did catch their 2-0 win against Jamaica, which, as we noted earlier, was the Ricardo Pepi show. Two second-half goals from the FC Dallas striker sealed that win and almost certainly sealed his future away from Big D. Very, very sad. However, unfortunately, they could not turn that into a win down in Central America, because a very much changed U.S. men's national team side went to Panama on Sunday and lost by a 0-0, bringing the ire of U.S. fans once again on Greg Berhalter. It is actually the United States' first defeat in qualifying. They sit 3 points behind leaders Mexico, so they're still in second. It is still early, but they face Costa Rica at 7 p.m. Eastern time. That's going to be on ESPN2, and that's on Wednesday, so the 13th of this week.
But not only their first loss in qualifying, do you know the last time the U.S. men's national team lost a competitive match? I guess is the distinction there.
I'm going to say, I mean, just because it was so high profile and it's the last time I can think of them playing it competitively, I'm going to say Trinidad and Tobago 2017.
More recent than that.
Oh, okay.
U.S. men's national team, the last competitive match they lost was 2019 Gold Cup against Mexico.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah, so I mean,
but
that's,
it's been it's been 2 years. They haven't lost in the last friendly they lost was in May. So anyway, they've had a very strong run. That's my point.
Yeah. No, it is a very good point. I obviously, and I think it was mostly the changes that he made to the team for that game in Panama. Because I mean, it was almost. I mean, he started Zardes. I think he started. I think he started Yunus Musah. So I mean, Ricardo Pepi wasn't even on the pitch. So yeah, and I'll be careful about what I say here because I could go off on a rant very, very quickly. But I will just say, Ricardo Pepi needs to stay in Dallas. He needs to stay. He's 19. He's going to be 19. I don't know if he maybe he turned 19, but he's going to be 19 for all of next season. He is not even 20 yet. He needs to stay in MLS. He needs to continue his development. He needs to not go off on a European tour. I don't care how good the money looks, Ricardo. Newcastle's miserable. Don't go there. It's rainy. It's they've got the most famous thing they have there is a bridge. It's a bridge that just turns over the Tyne. It's not that big of a deal. Please stay in Dallas and don't leave us. Good God. Because God knows the Hunts won't reinvest that money. And we absolutely have. If he leaves, there's nothing for us to. What's there to live for an FC Dallas fan if Ricardo Pepi leaves? He's the only thing about this season that has been any kind of good. That and maybe the standing section. But other than that, it's Ricardo Pepi, and he needs to stay. He's a Texas boy. He needs to stay in Texas, at least for another year. Just win us a cup, and then you can leave.
I will say, in reference to your previous point, not your odd FC Dallas rant,
Sorry.
that no, I'm kidding. I agree with you. I think the reason they lost to Panama was the change. You had seven changes to the starting lineup. Anthony Robinson and several U.S. players who play in the United Kingdom weren't available because of Panama and the United Kingdom's COVID status thing.
That's stupid.
They also wanted to rest the squad because you got three matches in 7 days. But clearly, you got the lineup wrong. Berhalter did. Pepe's 18; he's not even 19 yet. So, I mean, come on, let the kid start. I mean, how?
Seriously.
I mean, he can play three matches in 7 days. That's fine. The other thing that I would say, this two other quick things to note from that loss.
Yeah.
The first thing would be, I think it reveals how little depth this team has in the sense that how important chemistry is for this team. I mean, you make seven changes to any lineup, that's gonna be a big deal, but the drop off between certain players on that squad and the folks who replace them is pretty significant. Maybe not in a vacuum, but at least for the way they're playing right now. So I think that's good and bad. It means that when Berhalter has been getting it right, he's been getting it really right, but you can't just play musical chairs with this team, expect them to go out and win. Not that going to Panama is an easy win for the U.S. men's national team ever. But the other thing I would say is one thing to watch is Berhalter has a tendency to play guys who are better on the wings. He likes to play them through the middle. Musah is a good example, but there's three or four other guys that he tries to get to play through the middle who play better on the outside. And so I think that there might be some slight issues with the current roster as it's constituted and the way that Berhalter likes to play. Now, that may change if we qualify and the U.S. goes to the World Cup and you have everybody available to you, but that's something I would look at in future matches.
Fantastic analysis. This is why we have you here, for this, for that level of stuff. Yes, go ahead, Jordan.
So, Adam, I'll make sure on Boxing Day to send you a picture of my new Pepe number 9 Newcastle kit that I buy for myself for Christmas. Did
If you want to waste your money on that, that's your fine. He's going to be in Dallas. So says I.
Yeah.
Give
Okay.
him, give him, a, give him Dan Hunt's parking space. Give him Dan Hunt's house. Give him everything.
Keep telling yourself that, Adam. Okay. Did y'all discuss what happened after his brace against Jamaica about the articles specifically involving him and Giassi Zardes and about who is the better striker?
I mean, I think the obvious.
I probably wouldn't have clicked on an article with any headline referencing that
Yeah.
because that's just a one word. It's just a one-word article. Who's better?
Peppy.
Pepe, obviously.
Well, actually, y'all would have not clicked the article because the writer used analytics and basically tried to lay out the idea that because Zarda is more active in terms of build up and expected goals, and is just more involved in the attacking moves earlier, that he is the better striker and deserves to be starting.
Right. Okay. Here's the problem that I have with this, and this is the same issue. Here's what's dumb. So we try and do this analytics thing with football, and I get it. Stats are important. You can read into the numbers and you can really get down to it, and you can certainly moneyball football, and that's fine. But we do this weird thing in the United States with football, and I point to an example of this as the Audi Performance Index. I don't know if they use it anymore. They used to. And it used to be this thing during ESPN broadcasts of MLS matches where they talked about players and sort of how many points they get, and they get all these different points, and so it's intuitive, and the stats all add up, and we see who was the most important player, not just the one who scores the most goals or gets the most assists, but who turned up at the top of that every single time, the person who scored the most goals or the people who got the most assists. It's that simple. Ricardo Pepi scores you goals, he starts. Period. That's it. Yossi Zardes misses wide open chances, he doesn't start. Period. End of discussion. Stop trying to and this is not at either of you, this is at just the world in general. Stop trying to label stuff in a way that makes you sound smart. It's simple. Keep it simple. Goals and assists. That's it. End of discussion. Pepi starts. Zardes can come on later.
Out of all of the positions to throw the more quote unquote analytical or the war stat, if you will, in baseball speak, as opposed to wins. Like I agree that analytics can be really useful to represent the performance of players, particularly in positions that traditional stats maybe don't capture what they're doing. In terms of activity and building up and movement and miles run and all that stuff. But the one position I feel the two positions on the pitch that those kind of fringe analytics are less useful is striker and keeper. Like how many goals you score, how many goals you let up, like those are or how many saves you have, like those are the and Zardes looks more impressive. He's a bigger guy. He seems like somebody who should be dominating. The way he runs and he moves, he just looks like he's, the next number nine for the U.S. men's national team. And then Pepi comes out of nowhere and just barely touches the ball and scores two goals. And it's just like, he just has it. And it's hard to measure it, but he has it.
Well, the it is just, it's stuff that I think is kind of immeasurable. And baseball's different. Like, I get stats in baseball, that's a different thing. They obviously matter there, and they've been shown to matter different times. And I'm sure that we can talk about stats that do and don't matter in baseball, but that's a different sport, and analytics are going to be huge. I'm not saying analytics aren't good in football, but like you said, it does come down to being that simple. Who scores the most goals? Ricardo Pepi. Okay, he starts. That's it. End of discussion. I know there's things that we don't see in training, right? But I remember a few summers ago. This was the summer when Liverpool and Chelsea seemed to be in a race for who could make the most outrageous, stupid bid for a goalkeeper, but Liverpool brought Alisson in, and everybody was talking about, Alisson, and he's he can play with his feet, and he's more than just a goalkeeper. And I was just, that's his job, is to stop shots. And this past season, what did we notice the most when Liverpool would struggle? Who was struggling? Alisson. Why? He didn't stop shots. It wasn't because he wasn't hitting the correct pass to Salah or to Firmino or missing the midfield. It's that he made mistakes in the back and he wasn't stopping shots. Now, there may have been some other things going on there. I know he was having some issues with his family. He's had a very sad past year. But that's the point. He's got to stop the shots from going in. That is his job. If he doesn't do his job, he's not being a good goalkeeper. I don't care how good he is with his feet.
real quick. On that talk of analytics and team sports in particular, the real difference between, you know, sports like baseball and then like football and then American football is that with baseball, you know, you could use analytics to great effect because you're essentially dealing with an outcome between two different variables, a pitcher and a batter. So it could be a very true outcome-based, sport. Whereas with both footballs, there's 22 players on the field at all times. So therefore, it's really hard to analytically, you know, derive the value of someone because they're moving in concert with, you know, 21 other people, 21 other people. And, you know, expected goals and expected assists, are kind of very basic advanced stats. They do kind of do a decent job of showing you, okay, this player might be undervalued in a sense because, you know, he is producing more expected, you know, more dangerous chances per 90 in a more limited usage. So maybe we need to bump up his minutes on the field. But with a player like Ricardo Pepi, there is just something artistic about how he plays, you know, that you could see in team sports. It's something you really can't quantify. It's like a Patrick Mahomes no-look throw. You're watching something maybe 10 people in the world can pull off, you know, especially at such a young age, 18. I kind of feel like that, you know, Zardes had his chance. I mean, he's 27, and yes, for the work rate for he puts in and for, you know, the work he does prior to the actual, you know, the chance creation, that's good, but it's really difficult for players as they enter their prime to, you know, change, you know, their style and, you know, change the outcome, you know, become goal scorers. You know, that's really difficult. And Burkhalter just has something truly wonderful with Ricardo Pepi, and he just needs to hop on the train and ride it all the way to a World Cup, hopefully.
So does FC Dallas. Don't tell him. All right, so before we get into what this weekend looks like, actually, we're not going to get into that yet. We have an English Football League update from Caleb, but I do want to just remind everybody what the Premier League table looks like ahead of this weekend. So Chelsea, remember, sits top of the table. Liverpool, City, and United make up the remaining top four. Everton just sitting outside of that in fifth. The rest of the top half looks like this: Brighton, Brentford, Tottenham, West Ham, and Aston Villa. And then Arsenal, just outside of the top 10, the top of the table in 11th, Wolves, Leicester, Crystal Palace, Watford, Leeds, Southampton, Burnley, Newcastle, and Norwich are in the relegation zone. Let's take a trip down to the leagues below the Premier League. A lot of good action coming up, actually, this week and this weekend in the English Football Champion, the English Football League Championship. But for more of that, I will turn to our English Football League Championship correspondent, Mr. Caleb. What's going on down there?
Well, it's an interesting, I will say the championship is, it's always an interesting place to be. I think part of it is just the sheer number of squads makes things very interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of tough to really figure out exactly what's going on. But we'll go ahead and look at the table and then give you a couple quick notes about this upcoming week. AFC Bournemouth continues to lead the way. They have not lost. Fulham's former manager, Scott Parker, is there. You know, obviously it's still early in the season, but it's clear that he knows how to win in the championship.
Yes.
He plays a brand of football that frustrated Fulham fans last year in the Premier League because it was horribly unsuccessful, but was very successful year before in the championship. And that brand of football is to come in and be incredibly consistent. They don't – there's not a lot of risk. It's a very kind of slow build. You're okay with draws from time to time, but you don't have these, you know, wide swings that, for instance, Fulham is seeing under Marcus Silva, where they'll beat, Birmingham or Huddersfield, for instance. They'll go up and they'll beat them, 4-1 or beat a team 5-1, and then they'll come home and then they'll let up four goals in one half against Coventry and lose 4-1. So,
yeah,
you know, for everything, for all the criticism Parker got at Fulham in the Premier League, playing a very boring brand of football, it's been successful 2 out of the last 3 years, especially in the Championship. So Burnley to the top. West Brom, who I think will probably actually be the squad that ends up with one of the top two automatic promotion spots, is in second, rounding out your top six and currently in playoff spots. You've got Coventry, Stoke, City, Fulham, and QPR. There's actually going to be a West London derby this weekend between Fulham and QPR. And you may not know this, a little bit of fun trivia behind that matchup is 30 years ago, roughly, QPR, Queen's Park Rangers, and Fulham almost became the Fulham Park Rangers. They were almost merged into one.
Oh wow!
Program, yeah, in the late '70s. So, which would have been terrible. It had more to do with neither of them were performing particularly well, and it had something to do with the company that purchased the grounds. But anyway, they stayed two separate sides. They're going to face each other this weekend. So excited about that. Sheffield United, Stoke City will be good. Should probably be a sneaky good game because Sheffield United's been playing incredibly well. Stoke City's near the top. I would watch that if you can. And then Bournemouth's going to play Birmingham at home. That shouldn't be an issue for them at all. I would steer clear of that game. I think it's going to be pretty boring, unless you like Parker Ball, in which case, you know, tune in. So there's your dead last derby. Don't see them. I don't see them clawing their way up. They've been penalized. They're at the very bottom of the table. I think they only have 2 points at this point, which are full 6 points behind Peterborough and Barnsley. So I would expect Derby County to be relegated this season.
Sad Wayne Rooney. Yeah, that Fulham QPR match is going to be a humdinger, if I do say so myself. 7:30 a.m. Eastern time, and that should be on ESPN Plus for your Saturday. So thank you for that update, Caleb. I did look at some of our other lower leagues here, just very quickly. So Plymouth, Wickham, Wigan, and Sunderland all are looking very strong in League 1. Sorry about that, Jordan. Forest Green Rovers are top of League 2. But check this out. Harrogate Town, they are sitting in second place in League 2. They only won promotion, and they had to win it from the National League, from the playoffs in the 2019-2020 season. So good on Harrogate. Anybody know, just off the top of their head, the nickname, or one of the nicknames given to Harrogate Town? I'm going to guess not. But I just wanted to test and see if there was some knowledge out here.
Don't have the foggiest.
Okay. Jordan? Anything?
I was going to suggest the fish gutters.
No, no, it's not that. It's the sulfurites, because apparently that part of the UK was known for having some sulfur mines or what. I don't know. I don't know where you get sulfur. Anyways, the sulfurites. They also just call them town. So Harrogate Town looking good in League 2. That's your English Football League update, courtesy of Caleb. Thank you, Caleb. Yes.
Real quick, Adam. Yes, you do get sulfur from a mine.
Okay.
And ironically enough, I'm surprised no one ever gave them the nickname the Devils, just because of the smell of sulfur.
That is a good point.
Associate that with a more, you know, a more hellish place and atmosphere.
Yeah.
And to Caleb's championship update, I believe my body did a full shudder when I heard the phrase Fulham Park Rangers.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
What kind of chimera was that going to be? And thank God that idea got aborted pretty quickly.
I would
it's a fun story. It's worth you Google. It's worth going back in. And I'll say this. I only know about it because Fulham fans still talk about it. This was 1987, so this was discussed before I was born. And Fulham fans are still tweeting about it to this day. So it's something that is seared into the collective consciousness of the Cottagers. So it's worth going back and reading.
I would say that almost doesn't make sense just because I mean, to me, QPR and Fulham are in different parts of London. I mean, QPR is kind of on the western side, but I would consider them more central London, almost, whereas Fulham is most certainly West London, absolutely 100%. But that's just me. I know it's kind of a West London derby, but I would say they're a little bit closer to the middle.
Yeah, I mean, they're in Shepherd's Bush, so they're not...
Yeah.
Great area, by the way. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're not... they're within the Hammersmith and Fulham borough, so...
Oh, okay. Interesting. This is dropping the knowledge. This is what this podcast brings you. All right, let's look ahead to another exciting weekend of Premier League action. It is back after a long, long week away. I always feel terrible on weekends when there's not Premier League action. It's international weekend. So it starts out for you on Saturday, 7:30 a.m. Eastern time, Watford against Liverpool. I don't know if that's on NBCSN or if it's on Peacock. It hadn't been marked yet either way, so I'm not 100% sure. Sometimes it'll be on Peacock. Sometimes they will go ahead and put it on NBCSN, so check your local listings. What will definitely be on the NBCSN, though, is the 10 a.m. kickoff between Aston Villa and Wolves, a West Midlands derby for you. Like I said, that one on NBCSN. Other 10 a.m. kickoffs, Leicester versus Manchester United. That's going to be a good one. That's going to be on USA Network from the King Power Stadium. Manchester City take on Burnley, Norwich against Brighton. Southampton face off against Leeds, and then your late Saturday game is from the Brentford Community Stadium. It's Brentford against Chelsea, 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time on NBC/Peacock. On Sunday, Everton at Goodison Park. They take on West Ham. That's on 9 a.m. Eastern on NBCSN. Newcastle against Tottenham. Newcastle with their new owners. First game under the new regime. That's at 11:30 against Tottenham on NBCSN. And then the action rounds out on Monday, The action rounds out on Monday, October the 18th, Arsenal against Crystal Palace at 3 p.m. on NBCSN. And that brings us to the top shelf picks for this week. We've had a couple of not so great weekends, I'll just say, recently. But we're going to look to turn that around coming up this weekend. Just a reminder, Caleb used to still sit top of the table with 11 points. Jordan has 8, and I have 7. So I'm still rocking the bottom, but I'm hoping to change that this weekend. So the first one I have picked for this week is the West Midlands derby between Aston Villa and Wolverhampton Wanderers. This one's tough. Wolverhampton looking pretty good. Before the break, they were surging. They were looking pretty hot. Aston Villa doing pretty good this season, and they are at home. So I am going to say I'm going to say it's going to be a 2-0 win to Aston Villa. I think they're going to take that one down. Jordan, West Midlands derby, Villa Wolverhampton. What do you think is going to happen in this one?
It's going to be 1-0 to the Wolves.
All right. So Wolverhampton love from Jordan. Caleb, Villa Wolves.
I agree, 1-0, but going to Villa.
All right. Okay. This is a good sign. See, on the weeks when we're all in agreement, that's when we all seem to fail. So hopefully... Hopefully we get some better results for us this week.
If we split both sides, then one of us has to be right.
And then I picked both of the Sunday games for this week. So first up, Everton against West Ham. I think the last time out for Everton was that against Manchester United. Yes, good draw for them at Old Trafford. Last time out for West Ham. Not so good. That was the defeat to Brentford at home, which was incredibly annoying. But Jordan, you were picking first for this one. What's going to happen at Goodison Park on our Sunday morning?
Really? I do not get to pick the third match first. But anyways, going ahead.
This is the way of the top shelf picks. This rhythm was selected prior to the selection or to the purchase of Newcastle. Therefore,
this came to us from the gods.
We defer to the top shelf gods. Yeah.
Okay.
The pie gods have spoken.
The pie gods will not be kind to either team on Sunday. It's going to be a 1-1 draw.
Okay.
Rafa Benitez will score. Rafa Benitez Everton will score a late first half goal, but then give away a Mikel Antonio just goal in like the 73rd minute.
Very, very detailed prediction from Jordan. Caleb, Everton versus West Ham.
I'm going to give this to the Hammers 2-1.
Oh, thank you. It's very kind of you. I like Jordan's thinking, but I'm also behind and I really need the points. So I actually I'm going to agree with you, Caleb. I think it's going to go 2-1 to West Ham. I think that's a really, really good prediction, and hopefully we'll earn me some points. And then finally, Newcastle against Tottenham. See, I saved you. It's the best for last on this prediction, Jordan. You gotta think of that one. So Newcastle under new ownership, Tottenham are still Tottenham. They meet at St. James's Park for your late Sunday game. Caleb, you are up first. How will Newcastle fare in their first game under the Saudis?
I think Newcastle, with the tremendous boon that this purchase means for them and all of this momentum that they have, I think they're going to travel well. I think they're – this is at Tottenham.
St. James's. Nope.
Oh, it's at St. James's. Even better. So Newcastle, I think fans come out. I think it's an insane atmosphere. I think everybody's super excited. I think they've got a ton of energy. And I think Tottenham wins 2-0.
2-0. Newcastle wins 2-0.
No.
So
no, Tottenham wins 2-0. Sorry, Jordan.
Oh, man. Oh, man. I'm going to be a little kinder. I do think, just because I think they're away from home, I think we've seen Spurs struggle so far this season, and because I think it would be the absolute perfect way to commemorate this huge, just monumental change in the club atmosphere. I think the cherry on top is going to be a 1-1 draw at St. James's on Saturday. Jordan... on Sunday, excuse me. Jordan, no prizes for this. I imagine you're going to guess a Newcastle win, but what do you think is going to be the score?
Well, Adam, the pessimist in me would have, you know, said otherwise. Literally a week ago, I would have said this is a 2-0 loss, maybe a 2-1. But I have hope. I have hope for the first time since 2011. I'm gonna be honest with you. I cried when the ownership announcement was made. This is vaulted into the top five moments of my life. In all seriousness, it has. Obviously, my wedding is not gonna be bumped off the medal stand anytime, off the gold medal perch anytime soon.
Right.
So Sarah Beth doesn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, does she listen to this podcast? Because it sounds like she listens to this podcast.
No, she does.
Okay.
very begrudgingly and at my behest, but she does listen. Gotta get those numbers up. Gotta get those numbers up somehow, right, guys? But with a vigor and a fury that is going to be, you know, exuded from the crowd. I'm going to be honest. I don't know if we're going to be able to hear the commentary, especially if it's pitch side.
Oh God, this is the longest prediction ever.
Just because I think this is going to be just in such an intense atmosphere come Sunday. It's going to be a 2-1 Newcastle win. I'm calling it.
I thought you were going to predict a goalless draw. I was going to be like, oh my God, waited all that time for this. Okay, 2-1 to Newcastle. All right. Awesome. That would be a good game. I think it's going to be a great game on Sunday. I'm excited for that one. I'm just excited in general. I'm excited to wake up and watch Watford get pounded by Liverpool. That's how much I've missed the Premier League over this past week or so. So that's your show for this week. Like I said, the Premier League is back this weekend, and so will we be this week. And I think I'd like to go back to Sunday pod recording. It just seemed to work out the best. I know when we do in the middle of the week, sometimes schedules can get in the waves, but I appreciate both of you for making the time this week and talking about the international break that was and indulging me. And let's be honest, the coolest part is both of you guys, I mean, you're really good friends of mine. And so the coolest part of this whole entire thing is I get to schedule regular time to talk with you each and every single week. It's very nice. So thank you both.
So wholesome.
Yes.
That's awesome. Oh,
just very, very nice. Yeah. Although I am liking, I think now we can start to make fun of Jordan a little bit more because his club is one of the top ones. Hey, by the way, Jordan, just get ready for financial fair play, because now it applies to you and it's a bitch. More money, more problems.
I believe Caleb mentioned earlier that because of the lack of investment on the part of Mike Ashley through 14 years, we could spend upwards of like $600 million over the first 3 years. It's not going to affect us in terms of financial fair play. So
five signings in one window, you're going to be eating away at that pretty soon.
It sneaks up on you. So it is what it is. let me go get my edible gold sheets and my exquisite Italian black truffle, because I'm going to need it for this pie. Let's go eat some pies.
Let's go eat some pies. Some golden encrusted pies. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next week after the Premier League has returned. Take care.